dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXU Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, 101.1 Free Radio Santa Cruz, or KFAR Knoxville. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. There's a war raging everywhere on this planet. It's being waged with bombs and laws and money by the corporate class and their government allies in order to rule the world. Some of these warriors call this state of affairs a fight for freedom, and some of them call it a free market. But millions and millions are calling it slavery and are rising up in various ways to resist these would-be masters of the world. This week, we focus on that resistance from local to global. We'll conclude with part three of The Corporation, and then we'll hear how rural communities can and are successfully standing up to corporate incursions. But first, our own community is making the news this week. In March of 2003, on the eve of the U.S. invasion of Iraq, four people from Ithaca's Catholic worker community committed civil disobedience at a military recruiting center. Danny Burns, Claire Grady, Peter DeMott, and Teresa Grady poured their own blood in the lobby of the recruiting center, knelt in prayer, and waited to be arrested, while a crowd held an anti-war rally outside. The four were subsequently charged by Tompkins County District Attorney George Dentes with criminal trespass, a felony, and last year a local jury deadlocked 9-3 in favor of acquittal for the four. Realizing the difficulty of finding a local judge and jury who would convict in a retrial, Dentes vacated the case and referred it to the federal court. Last Friday, FBI agents arrived in Ithaca and began serving summons on each of the four. Teresa Grady learned the FBI was on its way to her home. She invited the press to wait with her to witness the agents' arrival. Peter DeMott's summons had already been served.
The charge is conspiracy to impede an officer of the United States, which is a felony charge, to the best of our knowledge.
It's a felony.
The maximum time in prison would be 6 years. Plus a hefty fine.
There has been a pattern of excessive charges in this case, which the defendants believe has been designed to intimidate. Teresa Grady.
What I would suggest that the first intimidation tactic was on the part of Dentes, George Dentes, by charging us with a felony charge. And really it was to try to cause us to make a plea bargain. They were wanting us to say, yes, we're guilty, and they would have just charged us with a misdemeanor at that time. However, we refuse because we don't believe that we are guilty. In fact, we do believe that we're upholding international law, acknowledging the fact that the United States has acted criminally in invading Iraq. We have committed war crimes, crimes against humanity, and crimes against the peace, but in particular, crimes against humanity in our use of depleted uranium and the wasting of the environment in Iraq will be for generations to come affecting the health of the people there, not to mention our own U.S. soldiers.
The state charge was framed as a property crime. The feds are taking a different approach. Danny Burns.
Also, I'd like to point out that when I say overcharging and exaggerating the charge, it seems to me that we're facing much more serious charges and more serious jail time than some of the soldiers who committed atrocities against the prisoners and that were being held in Iraq, which is a horrible crime, which none of their superiors have been charged. Interfering with the duty of a government officer The government officer in question was a recruiter who goes into the schools, our schools, and they get the names of every single student, regardless of the parents' permission or not. My sister Marie just opted out. You can tell the school not to give the military your name, but she took, I think it was the SAT, something like that.
Uh-huh.
Anna did, and they got the name automatically as soon as you take one of those tests. The recruiters, they lie to the recruits. We know our government has lied in the past, and
we know it was a lie that we went into this war, even.
And for us to think that they're not lying to us now would make us naive.
Sometimes impeding the activities of a government official is the right thing to do, said Claire Grady.
For me, the word that comes up over and over again is accountability. And we took responsibility for our actions going to the recruiting center and poured our blood sacramentally to name that blood that is being shed in our name, with our money, with our consent. This morning, right before getting a call to say that these FBI would probably be coming to my door, I was listening to a program on Democracy Now! On the radio, and they were interviewing a fellow who was talking about Eichmann and the banality of evil and just how atrocities occurred there by the efficiency and cooperation of everyone involved. Mm. When Eichmann went on trial, they didn't see a man with blood hanging from his fangs. They saw like a little man who was very efficient at his job. In fact, he didn't even support the entire program that the Nazis had, but he did his job well. Mm. And that's the part I would really like to bring up here. And I asked these FBI who came to the door what they thought of the lawless behavior of this current administration. They said they had no comment about that. Their work was just to serve the summons.
A member of the press asked the peace activists if they felt demoralized and whether their efforts were in vain. Danny Burns replied,
"Do I feel demoralized? No, I feel I feel sick to my stomach sometimes, quite a bit, because we're destroying families there. I mean, I got a little boy, and I hold him, and I can imagine anything happened to him.
Jesus.
And we are destroying families. We killed 600 civilians. That's the official count. 600 civilians in Fallujah. And we're creating incredible terrorism. And it's just horrendous. And for me, and not to speak out is a sin. And for when somebody sees somebody on TV appealing for their life, it's not just a U.S. hostage, it's an Iraqi civilian doing it. It's all of them. They just don't get the opportunity to see it on TV. And the difference between Donald Rumsfeld and George Bush and somebody standing there with a hood on them in front of a camera holding a sword is not much difference, because dead is dead, and they're as guilty as those hooded assholes on TV. The Bush administration is, and Rumsfeld is. They are killing them, they created it, and anybody who supported the war, if they are surprised even a little bit that this is happening, they created it. They helped create it by supporting the war.
At the end of the first trial, the prosecutor was visibly angry when the judge announced the jury could not reach unanimity. In the press, District Attorney George Dentes accused the jury of disregarding the law. Claire Grady.
As we were asked by a few jurors to meet with them, we understand that the 9 people that voted to acquit were following the law as it was given to them by Judge Sherman. And the 3 people who did not want to acquit didn't care what the law instructed them. And they said, "We just want to punish them." Okay, that's very significant, because it's contrary to the general assumption that you'll find in the paper, which is that, and Dentes put it out there, that they must have just disregarded the law.
The charge in the first trial, criminal trespass, required not only property damage in excess of $250, but knowledge by the defendants that they had no right to be where they were or to do what they did. The peacemakers, who spoke for themselves in court, asserted that they believed that the international laws on war crimes and genocide laid down during the Nazi tribunals and ratified by the United States placed an obligation on every citizen to defy their government when that government was embarked on a program of war crimes and genocide, which the U.S. attack on Iraq meets on several counts. The crime of aggression, an unprovoked assault under trumped-up pretenses for the actual purpose of gaining control of that nation's wealth, and genocide, the use of a toxic weapon of mass destruction, depleted uranium, whose effects last for hundreds of millions of years and have already caused an epidemic of cancers and horrific birth defects in Iraq. It appears intention will also be an issue in the upcoming federal case, Teresa Grady.
Conspiracy to impede an officer of the U.S. is the charge. And impede, within that word, they have to prove that we forced, intimidated, or threatened an officer of the U.S. Now, the four of us acted nonviolently, and there was absolutely no intention of intimidating, threatening, or forcing anyone to do anything. We did call people's conscience to action, to turn away from war, to refuse to fight and refuse to kill in the name of God and in the name of peace.
We waited at Teresa Grady's house for quite a while before the FBI showed up, but at last they arrived.
Got some of this for you.
Okay.
Friday, March 11th, 1:30.
Okay.
Need to be down to Bangor.
Who's this little guy, huh?
Just doing their job. And these four citizens believe they are also doing their jobs. Peter DeMott.
Our action took place at the recruiting station for both the United States Army and the Marine Corps. And having served in both the Marines and the Army, as a Marine in Vietnam and then in the Army in the Middle East, in Turkey, I just want to bring people's awareness to the fact that war only begets more war, and that the recruiting of soldiers for further wars, for this war and for the next war, is the very height of folly. And it's time for us now to turn away from war-making and to denounce our U.S. government as the chief terrorist of the world, and be willing to say that unequivocally and clearly, and to be able to articulate that in a nonviolent, loving way, and calling that to repentance, calling it to reform.
And we'll continue to follow that story as it develops. That very same day, February 18th, the New York State Court of Appeals issued a decision in the matter of Jeremy W. Alderson versus the New York State College of Agriculture and Life Sciences at Cornell University et al. 5 years ago, Alderson, a local radio and print journalist, had attempted to get information on what genetically engineered organisms Cornell is releasing in our communities. Lower courts have rejected Cornell's assertion that they are exempt from FOIL, New York's Freedom of Information Law, and Cornell has appealed the decisions to a higher level each time. Friday's decision affirmed that the Cornell Ag School is subject to FOIL, gave guidelines as to the types of documents that might or might not be subject to FOIL, and sent the case back to the lower court to determine specifics in this case. In a press release, Alderson commented, "This shows that when you take a swing at a bully, his head snaps back like anyone else's. My personal concern is for the way Cornell is endangering us all with its reckless release of genetically modified organisms." We'll bring you more on this story in a future program. The ability to get to the truth and tell it to others is a major battleground in the global class war. Most of the media is owned by the very corporations who are waging this war. and journalists who deviate are soon out on their ears, as the story we recently reported on regarding Monsanto's bovine growth hormone and Fox Television demonstrates. The government, whose officials commonly come from or work for this corporate class, has established a regulatory structure that has put most of the mass media under corporate control. It is now so powerful that corporate interests are in a position to use their media to punish politicians who don't toe the line. National public radio and television news has been transformed into a conduit for this corporate government spin. Only a handful of independent journalists working with limited resources and too few outlets have been left to sort the lies from the truth. But now it appears that limited resources are not the only significant threat. Dennis Bernstein of Flashpoints in Berkeley has more.
Mark Manning is a filmmaker from Southern California. He just got back from Iraq last week on Friday. He was in San Francisco. He was at the beach. His film was in the hotel room where he was staying. Mark has been at work on a film about the U.S. war and occupation of Iraq. When he was at the beach, when he was out of his hotel room, both his car and his hotel room was broken into. His footage that he took in Iraq, his cameras, and various equipment disappeared. This was 10 hours after he returned from Iraq, working on a film that he started in the U.S. in 2003. Before we get into the stealing of your equipment and your footage, tell us about what you were doing, what kind of film you were making, what you were learning about when you were in Iraq just recently.
Yeah, it was a segment of a film I've been working on, and I started in the United States before the war, and I started a film about what the United States people really knew about the war in Iraq, both why we were going before it, you know, before it started, why we were going, what it was about, why we were attacked on 9/11, about terrorism, and then all the way through the war, I kept traveling the country, going to different regions, different types of people, and engaging Americans' knowledge of the war, and after 2 years of that, it became pretty clear that the level of information that Americans had were pretty shallow, to say the least. So I decided to go over there myself and compare what's actually happening on the ground to what people hear about in the news here on our Western media. So I went there to just take a first-hand look, and I was there for about a month. I just went to the worst region in Iraq to get into the heart of it, and I went and stayed in the city of Fallujah and did a project there of filming what was going on, what it was like to be living under the occupation, and, you know, I just got to know the people, got their viewpoints, and shot what it was like to be just living in a as an Iraqi citizen in those situations and in that condition.
When were you in Fallujah?
I left Fallujah about a week ago. I was there for almost 3 weeks.
You left Fallujah only a week ago. You were there about 3 weeks. I guess you saw a great deal that many of us didn't hear much about. Could you give us a description of what you saw with your eyes, your senses, and through the lens of your camera?
Yeah, it's a pretty hard sight to see as a Westerner, you know. Fallujah is a city that used to hold about 600,000 people. It's an old, old city. It's thousands of years old. They call it the City of Mosques there. It's a very, very seriously Islamic city. And it's been destroyed. You know, there isn't a building there that doesn't have damage to it. It's been sacked. And there was some very, very hard fighting going on there, but there was also a pretty, I don't know, the city is devastated and the people are shattered. A lot of the people were left. They were given a week to leave the city. It was during the summer when they were given a week to live. After a week's notice, after 3 days, they were told they couldn't drive out. They had to walk out. So most of the city left with what they could carry on their shoulders during the summer. So they weren't dressed very well. They moved out into the countryside. They've moved out into refugee camps, not done by the UN, done by themselves. Chicken coops. They're living without clothes. And then the city was pretty much destroyed. It was some very serious fighting was done there. All kinds of airstrikes, house-to-house fighting. A lot of the houses have been torched. Policy of the military intervention was to fire any house that had had a resistance fighter in it or had been suspicious of any kind of activity. So I would say about 50% of the houses have been fired. About 60% of the houses have been destroyed totally. There's shells everywhere. I mean, the city has just been devastated.
What would trouble, do you think, U.S. officials, authorities, anybody, in terms of those prosecuting the war and the occupation, in terms of what you filmed? Are there things that you saw that you think perhaps the American administration, the Bush administration, would not want people to know?
I think what, you know, I mean, that's conjecture on my part, but my hunch is that they have to continue doing these operations. If they, the resistance in Iraq is growing. It started out about 3,000. I think it's up to about 200,000 now. The American troops are outnumbered. And they have to do these kind of operations again. They're going to probably do it in Mosul. They have to do it in other areas. And what we hear here in the media, we don't really see the images, you know. And I had the images, and I talked to the people. I talked to people who have lost their children, who have lost their husbands, who have lost their sons, who have lost their brothers, who have lost all their property, who are barely living, who are drinking contaminated water, who have seen chemical weapon strikes. You know, this is a civilian population that is at ground zero of a major American military offensive. And that's ugly. It's really, really ugly. And those images are, it makes it hard to live with yourself if you feel that you're responsible for that in some way as an American citizen. And I just really don't believe that those images are supposed to get out right now when the American military has to do other actions like that.
No. We're speaking with Mark Manning. He is a filmmaker based in Southern California. He has been working on a documentary about the occupation and war in Iraq, the U.S. occupation and war in Iraq. He returned on Friday. On Saturday, he was staying in San Francisco when he was out of his hotel room. Both his hotel room and his car was broken into, and crucial footage recently taken was stolen. His cameras were stolen 10 hours, just 10 hours after you were here. Do you think this is just a plain robbery? They want the cash. Is there any indication to you about this being more than just an everyday robbery?
Well, yeah, they knew what they were after. They left a lot of valuables behind. They knew where my tapes were. They were in my camera package, you know, and so they left a computer. They left some purses. They left wallets. They left jewelry. They left still camera material. They left computers. They grabbed one item, and that was my camera package and tapes. So draw your own conclusions there, but it was pretty obvious to me that they were after a certain item, and they got what they were after.
Was your car and your hotel room broken in at about the same time?
Yeah, it was the same afternoon, and we were probably 15 miles from the hotel room. So, you know, the strange thing is that I got sloppy. I was in Iraq. I don't know if you know the situation there, but every possible situation is actually happening there. There's spies everywhere. There's spy drones everywhere. There's robots. You're living in a science fiction movie, and you're extremely careful, you know. And I made the mistake of, when I got back to the United States, of letting my guard down. And part of that mistake was still believing that we have a democracy here, and that we have freedom, and that we have protection, and that our government wouldn't go after journalists. And, you know, that's my mistake, I guess. I thought the danger was in the wrong place. It's a little troubling to come back to the United States and have that happen. And, you know, if it was an operation, it was done with a lot of authority. And that's another scary thing to think about.
Did you report this to the police?
Yeah, I reported the burglary to the police. But, you know, they can't do anything.
Who do you think did this?
I really have no idea. You know, I'll go back to just saying that every spy agency, every type of government agency you can imagine is in Iraq. And they knew I was in Fallujah because I was the only Westerner that got there. So I couldn't tell you. You know, it's not the realm that I operate in. I'm a filmmaker and a journalist, and I'm trying to get the truth and the truth out to the American people. That's out of my league. You know, somebody that was good, and that's all I know.
Why do you say they were good?
Well, they knew where I was. They knew where the tapes were. They didn't leave any marks, you know. They didn't even leave a break-in mark. They just came in and took the bag just to know where I was, when I was going to be there, when I had left the motel room, where we were in the city, following us without, you know, me noticing. It's not amateur.
Are you feeling a little bit concerned, intimidated now? Are you frightened for yourself, for your friends, for your family?
Yeah, it leaves that on you. You know, it gives you a sense of that you're not really free. I think it's more that it sort of shatters your illusions of that you're living in a country that really stands for a democracy. I mean, what affects me the most is that if you have a democracy, one of the most important parts of that is a free press. And if you have a government that starts going after the press, you are on the edge of the collapse of that civilization. And that is what troubles me the most. And I just would add one quick thing, is that the situation in Iraq is the reporters you're talking about, the Western media, they don't leave their hotel rooms anymore. And that's why I ended up on somebody's radar, as I went through the horrendous experience of actually going out and living with the people. It's a highly dangerous thing to do, but it's what's required. And ironic as it is, it turns out that the actual danger to me was not from the Iraqi people, not from the terrorists, not from the insurgency, as they call it, but from, you know, my own government.
We're also concerned because we, as an alternative radio station and network, depend on people like you, because we believe the corporate media is dead because the reporters are owned by the corporations or controlled by the corporations who are gaining from the war. So the work that you do as an independent journalist and filmmaker is very, very important to getting out an alternative perspective. So we're going to watch this case very closely. We thank you for your courage, and we hope you will keep us posted if you find out anything more.
Mark Manning, speaking with Flashpoint's Dennis Bernstein. This is Unwelcome Guests on WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, 101.1 Free Radio Santa Cruz, or KFAR Knoxville.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news relating to the intersection of media and democracy. I'm John Anderson.
And I'm Kimberly Cronick.
Volunteers and friends of community television dodged a bullet at the FCC this month when commission staff rejected a proposal from the cable industry to kill off local control of cable franchise agreements. For the last 4 years, cable TV's trade lobby has been pushing a plan to deregulate cable systems in 41 states, calling local oversight unnecessary due to competition from satellite broadcast services. Had the FCC taken local control away, it would have most likely sounded the death knell for public access TV channels. Even so, cable companies are pushing state by state now to free themselves of the requirement to set aside a few channels for community, school, and government use. On February 15th, supporters of public access TV in Arizona rallied at the state capitol in Phoenix, where Jerry Dobbs of Access Phoenix says two bills are pending that would weaken local control of cable systems.
There will only be two channels negotiated with any city, and those two channels are government and, of course, education. But that means there's no room for us.
If you're looking for news about politics, you won't find it on television. That's the headline from a study conducted by the Norman Lear Center Local News Archive at the University of Southern California. Researchers sampled local TV newscasts from 44 markets around the country during the November election cycle and found that, on average, local TV newscasts spent 3 minutes on election stories. Martin Kaplan, director of the Lear Center, says the vast majority of that time focused on the presidential race.
Local news doesn't cover local politics. In 2004, what we found was that the presidential race sucked all the media oxygen out of the room.
Viewers got about 75 seconds of non-presidential election stories from a typical local TV newscast. Political advertising dwarfed actual news coverage, what with more than $1.6 billion spent on campaign spots at the local level alone.
There were Senate races that were considered likely or leaning, where the ratio of ads to news was 17 to 1. House races across the board, the average ratio was about 5 in ads to 1 of news.
Another surprising finding was that coverage of Iraq and U.S. foreign policy in general occupied a scant 38 seconds in an average newscast. The typical newscast was heavily weighted towards sports, weather, and crime, although advertising took up the largest block of time, nearly 9 minutes worth.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a joint production of the Illinois Initiative for Media Policy Research at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization dedicated to media democracy. For more information, visit our website at freepress.net.
We began this three-part series analyzing the nature and peculiar personality of the modern business corporation. In part two, we saw the corporation extending its influence into every sphere of life. In this concluding hour, we consider the corporation's history of indifference to democracy and the high-stakes struggle facing grassroots movements as they challenge the dominant institution of our time.
The Corporation, a documentary by Mark Akbar, Jennifer Abbott, and Joel Bakken. Part 3, Reckoning.
The prospect that two-thirds of the world's population will have no access to fresh drinking water by 2025 has provoked the initial confrontations in a worldwide battle for control over the planet's most basic resource. When Bolivia sought to refinance the public water service of its third largest city, the World Bank required that it be privatized, which is how the Bechtel Corporation of San Francisco gained control over all of Cochabamba's water, even that which fell from the sky.
Oscar Olivera, Coalition in Defense of Water and Life. And these laws and contract also prohibited people from gathering rainwater. So rainwater was also privatized. Unpaid bills gave the company rights to repossess the debtors' homes and to auction them off. People had to make choices from eating less and paying for water and basic services and not sending children to school, not going to the hospital and treating illnesses at home, or in the case of retired people who have very low incomes, they had to go out and work in the streets. Gabriel Erbas, environmentalist. The Bolivian government is responsible for obeying the World Bank's demands, but ultimately, the guilty parties are the transnational companies that have tried to rake off profits from what little is owned by the people of Cochabamba. Our governments, sadly, are just puppets for these companies. Then with the slogan, "The water is ours, damn it," the people took to the streets to protest.
The price this beleaguered country paid for World Bank loans was the privatization of the state oil industry and its airline, railroad, electric and phone companies. But the government failed to convince Bolivians that water is a commodity like any other.
Entonces, ahí sí,
And then we witnessed how the government defended the transnational interests of Bechtel. People want water.
La gente quería agua, no gases.
People want
la gente
justice,
quería
not
justicia
bullets.
Y no balas.
Transnational corporations have a long and dark history of condoning tyrannical governments. Is it narcissism that compels them to seek their reflection in the regimented structures of fascist regimes?
Howard Zinn, author of A People's History of the United States.
There was an interesting connection between the rise of fascism in Europe and the consciousness of politically radical people about corporate power. Because there was a recognition that fascism rose in Europe with the help of enormous corporations.
Mussolini was greatly admired all across the spectrum. Business loved him. Investment shot up.
Noam Chomsky, Institute Professor, MIT.
And suddenly when Hitler came in Germany, the same thing happened there. Investment shot up in Germany. He had the workforce under control. He was getting rid of dangerous left-wing elements. Investment opportunities were improving. There was no problems. These are wonderful countries.
Michael Moore, award-winning documentary filmmaker.
I think one of the greatest untold stories of the 20th century is the collusion between corporations, especially in America, and Nazi Germany. First, in terms of how the corporations from America helped to essentially rebuild Germany and support the early Nazi regime, and then, when the war broke out, figured out a way to keep everything going. So General Motors was able to keep Opel going, Ford was able to keep their thing going, and companies like Coca-Cola, because they couldn't keep the Coca-Cola going, so what they did was they invented Fanta Orange for the Germans. And that's how Coke was able to keep their profits coming in to Coca-Cola. So when you drink Fanta Orange, that's the Nazi drink that was created so that Coke could continue making money while millions of people died.
Edwin Black, author, IBM and the Holocaust.
When Hitler came to power in 1933, his goal was to dismantle and destroy the Jewish community. This was an enterprise so fast that it required the resources of a computer. But in 1933, there was no computer. What there was the IBM punch card system, which controlled and stored information based upon the holes that were punched in various rows and columns. Naturally, there was no off-the-shelf software as there is today. Each application was custom designed, and an engineer had to personally configure it. It was the IBM machinery and punch card system which enabled the entire extermination by labor program. This is where hundreds of thousands of Jews and other enemies of the Reich were simply worked to death based upon their location, their job skills. They were moved from place to place, and then there was slave labor billing. All of it was done on IBM machines. Now, the concentration camps, it's a very, very special case. Millions of people of all religions and nationalities and characteristics went through the concentration camp system. Hundreds of camps, thousands of sub-camps. That's an extraordinary traffic management program that required an IBM system in every railroad direction and an IBM system in every concentration camp. Now, this is a typical prisoner card. There are 130,000 of these at the Bundesarchiv in Berlin. And the archivist there thought they had no connection whatsoever to punch cards. But upon closer examination, we see there are little boxes where all the information is to be punched in. We compare this information to the code sheet for concentration camps. And here you see Auschwitz is one, Buchenwald two, Dachau is three. And by the way, it's not three, it's 003. Now, what kinds of prisoners were they? They could be a Jehovah's Witness for two, a homosexual for three, communist for six, or a Jew would be eight. Now, what was their status in these various concentration camps? One was released, two was transferred, four. 4 was executed, 5 was suicide, and 6, code 6, Sonderbehandlung, special treatment, meant the gas chamber or sometimes a bullet. They would punch that number in, the material was tabulated, the machines were set, and of course, the punch cards, by the millions, had to be printed, and they were printed exclusively by IBM, and the profits were recovered just after the war.
I really do believe that that particular accusation has been fairly discredited as a serious accusation. That is, the fact that they have used equipment.
Irving Lebowski Berger, Vice President of IBM Technology and Strategy Group.
You know, that is a fact. But how they got it, how much cooperation they got, and any kind of collusion, trying to connect dots that are not connected, I think that's the part that is discredited. Generally, you sell computers, and they're used in a variety of ways, and you always hope they're used in the more positive ways possible. If you ever found out they are used in ways that are not positive, then you would hope that you stop supporting that. But do you always know? Can you always tell? Can you always find out?
Edwin Black.
IBM would, of course, say that it had no control over its German subsidiary. But here on October 9th of 1941, a letter is being written directly to Thomas J. Watson with all sorts of detail about the activities of the German subsidiary. None of these machines were sold. They were all leased by IBM, and they had to be serviced on site once a month, even if that was at a concentration camp such as Dachau-Buchenwald. This is a typical contract with IBM and the Third Reich, which was instituted in 1942. It's not with the Dutch subsidiary. It's not with the German subsidiary. It is with the IBM Corporation in New York.
You know, as it happens.
Peter Drucker, founder, Drucker School of Management.
I discussed it more than once with old Mr. Watson, and I was around at the time. I'm not saying that Watson didn't know that the German government used punch cards. He probably did know. After we had very few customers, Watson didn't want to do it. Watson, not because he thought it was immoral or not, but because Watson, with a very keen sense of public relations, thought it was risky.
It should not surprise us that corporate allegiance to profits will trump their allegiance to any flag. A recent U.S. Treasury Department report revealed that in 1 week alone, 57 U.S. corporations were fined for trading with official enemies of the United States, including terrorists, tyrants, and despotic regimes.
And some of the corporations were Amazon.com, Caterpillar, Chevron Texaco, Citibank, ExxonMobil, Walmart,
any community Wilson. Somewhere along a scale running all the way from democracy to despotism. This man makes it his job to study these things.
Well, for one thing, avoid the comfortable idea that the mere form of government can of itself safeguard a nation against despotism.
For big business, despotism was often a useful tool for securing foreign markets and pursuing profits. One of the U.S. Marine Corps' most highly decorated generals, Smedley Darlington Butler, by his own account, helped pacify Mexico for American oil companies, Haiti and Cuba for National City Bank, Nicaragua for the Brown Brothers brokerage, the Dominican Republic for sugar interests, Honduras for U.S. fruit companies, and China for Standard Oil. General Butler's services were also in demand in the United States itself in the 1930s, as President Franklin Delano Roosevelt sought to relieve the misery of the Depression through public enterprise and tougher regulations on corporate exploitation and misdeeds.
More power to you, President Roosevelt. The entire country's behind you, thrilled with hope and patriotism.
But the country was not entirely behind the populist president. Large parts of the corporate elite despised what Roosevelt's New Deal stood for. And so, in 1934, a group of conspirators sought to involve General Butler in a treasonous plan.
The plan as outlined to me was to form an organization of veterans, to use as a bluff or as a club at least, to intimidate the government.
But the corporate cabal had picked the wrong man. Butler was fed up with being what he called a gangster for capitalism.
I appeared before the Congressional Committee, the highest representation of the American people, under subpoena to tell what I knew of activities, which I believe might lead to an attempt to set up a fascist dictatorship. The upshot of the whole thing was that I was supposed to lead an organization of 500,000 men, which would be able to take over the functions of government.
A congressional committee ultimately found evidence of a plot to overthrow Roosevelt. According to Butler, the conspiracy included representatives of some of America's top corporations, including J.P. Morgan, DuPont, and Goodyear Tire. Today's chairman of Goodyear Tire knows, for corporations to dominate government, a coup is no longer necessary.
Corporations have gone global.
Sam Hibara, former CEO, Goodyear, world's largest tire corporation.
And by going global, the governments have lost some control over corporations, regardless of whether the corporation can be trusted or cannot be trusted. Governments today do not have over the corporations, the power that they had and the leverage that they had 50 or 60 years ago. And that's a major change. So governments have become powerless compared to where they were before.
Ira Jackson, Director, Center for Business and Government, Kennedy School, Harvard.
Capitalism today commands the towering heights and has displaced politics and politicians as the new high priests and reigning oligarchs of our system. So capitalism and its principal protagonists and players, corporate CEOs, have been accorded unusual power and access. This is not to deny the significance of government and politicians, but these are the new high priests.
Mark Barry, author of Spooked: Espionage in Corporate America.
In 1998, I was invited to Washington, D.C. to attend this meeting that was being put together by the National Security Agency called the Critical Thinking Consortium. I remember standing there in this room and looking over on one side of the room, and we had CIA, NSA, DIA, FBI, Customs, Secret Service, and then on the other side of the room, we had Coca-Cola, Mobil Oil, GTE, and Kodak. And I remember thinking, I am like in the epicenter of the intelligence industry right now. I mean, the line is not just blurring, it's just not there anymore. And to me, it spoke volumes as to how industry and government were consulting with each other and working with each other.
As 34 nations of the Western Hemisphere gathered to draft a far-reaching trade agreement, one that would lay the groundwork to privatize every resource and service imaginable, thousands of people from hundreds of grassroots organizations joined to oppose it. Canada's top business lobbyists and its chief trade representative discount the dissent in the streets. For them, the America's 800 million citizens speak with one voice.
Nice to see you.
Well done.
On your strong advocacy of truth, justice, wisdom, and all those things.
Pierre Pettigrew, Minister of Trade, Canada.
I was looking yesterday at the statements at the inauguration, the opening ceremony. What an extraordinary progress.
Absolutely.
Over the last 15 years.
Absolutely.
When you heard such
a common language.
A common language. Yes, and from the most developed to the least, it was extraordinary that now that we see the benefits of trade, more and more people want to buy it.
Absolutely.
Because we do realize that it helps everyone, from the poorer to the better off. So
a lot of these countries
good.
Are not saying we want to get off, they want to get on.
Exactly.
So
no one wants out.
Is,
everyone
right.
wants in.
Yeah. Anyway, well done.
So,
thank you. So far, so good.
Good.
Robert Keyes, President and CEO, Canadian Council for International Business.
I'm inside, and this is all outside. So that's the way it is.
So what do you think when you look at all this?
Well, it's, I think it's too bad that this has erupted.
Corporation, Democracy Limited. Robert Keyes.
Does there need to be some measure of accountability? Yes. And I think the business community recognizes that. But that accountability is in the marketplace. It's with their shareholders. It's with the public perception and the public image that they are projecting. That's, if companies don't do what they should be doing, they're going to be punished in the marketplace, and that's not what any company wants.
Michael Walker, the Fraser Institute, a market solutions think tank.
Don't find yourself relying on government. Find yourself relying on trying to create in the marketplace an incentive for corporations to do the right thing.
Ira Jackson.
There's a new market. These guys and gals aren't out there because government's putting a gun to their head or because they've suddenly read a book about transcendental meditation and global morality.
My inner voice says, honor my inner child.
Mine says, love everyone.
My inner voice says, I like a Wendy's bacon mushroom melt.
They're there because they understand the market requires them to be there, that there's competitive advantage to be there.
Boy, talk about inner peace.
Sir Mark Moody Stewart, former chairman, Royal Dutch Shell.
I am listening to your concerns. I worry about climate. I worry about pollution. I do not have all the answers to this, but we are prepared to work with you, with society, with NGOs, with governments to address it. So you rebuild the trust so that you come back to a new kind of trust. And then the ultimate goal is then to become a corporation of choice.
Shell advertisement.
He believes that almost half our energy could one day come from renewable sources. He's been called a dreamer and a crank.
And I've been called a hippie.
And more recently, a project manager for Shell.
I ask myself oftentimes why so many companies subscribe to corporate social responsibility.
Ray Anderson, CEO of Interface, world's largest commercial carpet manufacturer.
I'm not sure it's because they necessarily want to be responsible in an ultimate way, but because they want to be identified and seen to be responsible. But who am I to judge? Who am I to judge? It's better they belong than not belong. It's better that they make some public profession than the opposite.
Social responsibility isn't a deep shift because it's a voluntary tactic.
Elaine Bernard, Executive Director, Trade Union Program, Harvard.
A tactic, a reaction to a certain market at this point. And as the corporation reads the market differently, it can go back. One day you see Bambi, next day you see Godzilla.
How do you define socially responsible?
Milton Friedman, Nobel Prize-winning economist.
What business is it of the corporation to decide what's socially responsible? That isn't their expertise. That isn't what their stockholders asked them to do. So I think they're going out of their range, and it certainly is not democratic.
Richard Grossman, co-founder, Program on Corporations, Law, and Democracy.
The only responsible corporation is a subordinate corporation, a corporation where the people running it take orders from the body politic. They don't run the body politic.
I don't really care what the chairman of General Motors thinks is an appropriate level of emissions to go out the tailpipe of General Motors' automobile.
Robert Monks, shareholder activist.
He may have a lot of scientists, he may be a very good person, but I didn't elect him to anything. He doesn't have any power to speak for me. These are decisions that must be made by government and not by corporations. And it's very dangerous, it's very beguiling to say, why don't we have a philosopher king as a corporate CEO? Let him decide, let the great leader decide. History, it would be very rude with that suggestion, and they would say that power that's accountable to nobody is not really power that we can tolerate in this world.
Naomi Klein.
you take this to its logical conclusion, one would have an image that we are in fact at this the end of the world is nigh, and we are all completely brainwashed, and there's no space left, and I don't believe we're there yet. And I think it's really important that we don't overstate the case, and that we admit that there are cracks and fissures in all of these corporate structures. And sometimes when a corporation is concentrating on one particular project, they look the other way and all kinds of interesting things happen in the corner.
Dr. Vandana Shiva.
It is the case in every period of history where injustice based on falsehoods, based on taking away the right and freedoms of people to live and survive with dignity, that eventually, when you call a bluff, the tables turn.
Mark Kingwell, philosopher.
I think it's too simple to say, let's get rid of all corporations and that will solve the problems of the world. There are things that can be done, and only can be done, it seems, when people organize and are, at least in part, motivated by profit. And so, to my mind, this is a question of tendencies run out of control or influence well beyond the bounds of legitimacy.
It's a relationship issue between human beings and our institutions.
I believe in that there should be strong governmental controls on these corporations in terms of their behavior, in terms of what they can do. People will say, well, that's a different kind of government. Well, what kind of government is that other than a democracy? These companies should be more democratic. The whole economy should be more democratic, meaning that you and I have a say in what's going on. Right now, we have little or no say in what's happening.
The structures of transnational economics are up and running. They're having good and bad effects all around the world. Lots of bad ones, for sure. But to my mind, it's not whether the effects are good or bad that's the primary question. The primary question is, how do we make them democratically accountable? Because only if we do that can we even assess the goodness or badness and have some influence over it.
Well, a group in Arcata is speaking out against corporate power, and it's asking for your support. The group called Citizens Concerned About Corporations is organizing a signature drive to get an initiative on the November ballot. The initiative would require the city of Arcata to host two town hall meetings in which participants would discuss large corporations' power structure. It would also require the city to form a committee to advise leaders about corporate policies.
Public meeting, Arcata, California.
I can't think of a better place to be. If this many people around the country would do this instead of watching Super Bowl Sunday, our nation would be controlled by the people, not by the corporations.
Corporations are not accountable to the democratic process. That's what this is about. I don't want to make decisions about everything that goes on in their corporation, but I do have a strong belief that they need to be held accountable to us. This is our place to live. This is our place.
As I understand, Measure F would be to stop in some way, shape, or form, not necessarily punitive, the activities of corporations that cause harm to the citizens of Arcata and the environment that we depend on for life.
The problem is the huge corporations that are not here. One of the things that was talked about here was harm. And the question I have for those people is, who determines what harm is? You can have a corporation that obeys every law of the land and can still be producing harm.
My question is, can it be done differently? What are we afraid of? I mean, are all the businesses going to leave Arcata? I don't think so. And if they did, we'd deal with it, or we'd figure it out, or we'd do something different. We're creative people. I just don't see why we're afraid.
The path we're on that Measure F would lead to is the road to serfdom. If you think it's tough making a decision where to buy your stuff today, how tough do you think it is when there's only one provider, and it's the state? And by the way, you don't get to have this little democracy forum in those communities either.
This issue that we are in some way proposing central government control or socialism really is absurd. What we're proposing is democratic authority over corporations.